Thanks for coming. I'm Miles Studemeyer. And so this is Condensed Matter Explorations, as you guys know. And I tried to come up with a theme for what I wanted to cover. And that theme is weakly and strongly correlated electrons. Okay, so well, first, just quickly about me. So I work in condensed matter, probably obviously, and my specialty actually is numerical methods. So if you guys want to learn more about that as the class goes through, I could probably add some extra topics in. But so I'd be curious to hear back from you about some things you'd like covered in the second and third week. But basically, the idea is we're going to be going through different stories about sort of techniques and approaches for these two classes of electron systems, and basically try to show you by example what these mean. So I can define these for you right now, but then I also want to show by working through both different examples and different techniques for dealing with these two classes to give you a better feel for like why this distinction is there in condensed matter and what sort of implications it has. And I'm curious about you guys. So how many of you are pretty sure you want to specialize in condensed matter in your research? Just maybe three or four of you. What are some other specialties, that you guys are thinking about? Quantum info? Yep, okay, so some of the stuff I'm planning on talking about next week may touch on quantum info in the sense of how we think about wave functions of certain 1D systems, for example. And these ways of organizing wave functions have connections to quantum information. Actually, the thing I want to do this week, density functional theory, I think potentially has connections to quantum information. There's actually a whole session about that at March meeting in San Antonio just the other week about basically density functional theory, quantum information. So this might be like an emerging area of research. So it's a pretty old school topic actually, density functional theory, but it may be kind of having a renaissance in terms of different ways of thinking about it. Okay, so just by way of a bit more introduction, you've probably heard some of these things, but so this is about condensed matter physics. Right, so condensed matter physics is sort of a marketing term, right? It used to be called like solid state physics, but I think they decided that was too narrow and a bit, kind of boring and off-putting. So this is sort of a marketing term that's supposed to make it sound cooler, right? But the thing is, we could just think about it very broadly. So condensed matter physics is really just a certain subdiscipline of quantum many-body physics. So there's no reason to put these things into too narrow of a box and say like, okay, we only think about, metals and insulators, right? I mean, it's got all kinds of overlap with field theories and with quantum information, things that are also very much concerned with what happens when you get a large number of quantum degrees of freedom together and let them interact and that sort of thing, right? Of course, you guys have probably heard this too, but when you're dealing with quantum many-body physics, it's not just adding stuff together, right? There's this concept due to Phil Anderson called more is different. And that's just a catchy way of talking about, collective behavior. Right? And so we know this from just sociology, right? There's like mobs of people, for instance, right? So if you get a lot of people together, they might act really differently from how one person may act individually, this kind of thing, right? So we're going to be looking at examples of collective behavior where if you get many electrons together, they can act very, very differently. There's sort of two paradigmatic cases of how they can act very differently from an individual electron, especially in this, we'll see in some of these strongly correlated examples that basically the electrons totally lose their identity and kind of the low energy stuff making up the problem looks totally different from an electron. Like it might be a third of an electron or something like that, something very different. Just to define a little better what I mean by weakly correlated and strongly correlated electrons, let's give some examples. Okay, so and I'll give a first attempt at a definition, though it's probably ultimately kind of futile to try to come up with like perfect definitions for these things. So that's why examples are better. Okay, So here's my like first pass and attempt of defining these terms, right? So basically, weakly correlated systems of electrons, what we mean is that there's a quantitative effect of interactions. Okay. And but basically not really too much of a qualitative effect. So basically things still look like, you know, a gas of electrons or something like that. But of course interactions are important. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to give some examples. That would be.
That's not the only one.
Sorry?
That's not the only one.
Not the only one. Yeah. Exactly. So right. So one of the key examples is metals. And I'm not just talking about classes of systems, but sort of phenomena, right? So along with metals, we have the phenomenon of a Fermi surface, okay? And then there's a more refined understanding of these, which goes by Fermi liquids. So this is really making more precise this notion that, you know, you get a bunch of electrons together, and in some cases, you still get what looks like electrons, although they're sort of corrected by interactions and by the potential that they move in and these kind of things, okay? So that's probably one of the cornerstone examples that you think of, but we'll put a few more. Strongly correlated, you know, essentially that's just a fancy way of saying that there's a qualitative effect. And then, of course, if you say there's a qualitative effect, it goes without saying there's also a quantitative effect, right? But you know, it's even stronger, basically. So here, interactions is like totally reshape the problem. You get something that's very different from just what isolated electrons just moving past each other like ships in the night. You know, that's kind of what's going on over here. Here, you know, they really are sort of having to pay attention to each other. And then very surprising and very drastically different things can happen on this side. Though this side is also extremely interesting, right? Like a Fermi surface is a really remarkable thing. So one thing I want to emphasize to you guys is these are both totally, you know, equally frontiers of research. I mean, partly on this side, you can do a lot theoretically. So that allows us to go very, very far. Over here, we can't do as much, but everything we find is very surprising and cool. So so maybe the most kind of, you know, like kind of one of the earliest examples of strongly correlated behavior that we know of is this concept of a Mott insulator. And I'll discuss this at length and make this more precise. But basically, this is just an insulator that is an insulator due to interactions, you know, primarily. That's sort of the idea. Over here, you have a concept called a band insulator. And this is an insulator that's due more to the periodic potential of the system. Okay, so that's why it's sort of a weakly correlated effect. It's like the electrons are just looking at the potential, but they're not really looking at each other. Over here, they're totally paying attention to where the other electrons are. And that's sort of the key difference, right? And then, let's see, can you guys give some more examples of richer examples over here, the weakly correlated side? So think about things maybe you can describe in mean field theory, this kind of thing. Or there's some new fancy examples of other things that can happen when you have band structures. Yeah, exactly, topological insulators. So this is what I mean about this side is not necessarily boring, right? Like your first thought, maybe weakly correlated, weak, boring, right? Or weak, you know, not interesting or something. But Fermi surfaces are super interesting, right? And there's a lot of research going into other systems that may have Fermi surfaces, but which are not Fermi liquids. That's an interesting topic of research. Band insulators, okay, maybe those are kind of boring, though it's still remarkable. And then topological insulators, right? So these are actually like a type of band insulator that that sort of has a band that's like tied in a knot or something, like very roughly, right? But it's an interesting thing. And it has interesting, if you put it on a finite size system with edges, the edges do weird stuff. Basically, it's like a system that's always coated by a metal, but it's not like the metal is just brushed on. It's somehow intrinsically coming out of the bulk, something like this. And then another example is a thing called a vial semi-metal. If we have time, I may cover these. And this is like something where you have, instead of a Fermi surface, you have like these Fermi points, but they're somehow intrinsically there, and you can't get rid of them no matter what you do. So you can push on the system, you can apply pressure, you can change details of the system, and these points will just kind of move around, but you can't make them open. The only way you can get rid of them is if you bring them together, basically. It's like graphene, but it's sort of even more you know, protected, right? So graphene is, maybe these points are protected by certain symmetries, but then there's other things you can do to the system that'll immediately make these points disappear in graphene. But here you can't. there's like almost nothing you can do except to maybe bring them together and have them annihilate, essentially. It's very interesting. And then finally, another key example is the integer quantum Hall effect. Okay, and then there's many more, and probably many we don't know about. So then on this side, a few more. Okay, so along with mod insulators, you have to mention anti-ferromagnets. You know, and magnets really live on both sides of this. Kind of depends on the mechanism. We're going to go into different mechanisms for how magnetism arises. But some of the most interesting mechanisms involve strong correlation. So basically, it's like the electrons stay apart. And so once they stay apart, they're kind of their charge degrees of freedom are sort of stuck. But then they can still kind of, you know, move their arms if you want. Like their spin can kind of do stuff. So, and then there's some residual interactions that are left over after the charges stop moving. And that's what leads to, generally, to anti-ferromagnetism, though also can lead to other more interesting effects.
So
it depends. So we'll go into that. But basically, there's this totally kind of uniform electron gas picture of ferromagnetism called stoner ferromagnetism. And it's just this idea that basically electrons try to avoid each other by aligning their spins. And when they align their spins, their statistical correlations make them avoid each other more. So that whole story kind of is over here, more or less. But then, depending on the more complicated you go over here with mechanisms for magnetism, like depending on the bond angle between different, d electron oxygen, d electron bonds and stuff, you can get ferromagnetic interactions over here. So it gets pretty interesting over here. We'll talk about that. And so in general, you have, coming out of this, you have spin models more generally. And this kind of gets into the quantum information part, where, you know, things were inspired by Kennett's matter, but then you kind of get this general class of models involving spins on lattices, and then those just become interesting by themselves. And they can just do all kinds of rich behaviors, and there's all kinds of interesting research here. You know, most interesting type would be these things called frustrated magnets. Very unfortunate name, but they're very interesting. And so these are basically just magnets where the interactions compete, and you can't make all the interactions happy. So they basically just kind of fluctuate and fluctuate forever. Quantum mechanically, it's very interesting. So maybe the most stunning example of strong correlation on this side is the fractional quantum Hall effect, which I plan to talk about. I don't think you guys have covered that in your previous courses, correct? So we'll talk more about that. Basically, the electrons sort of melt into a liquid, and then the low energy degrees of freedom are like these fractional charge bubbles or something. It's pretty cool. And then spin liquids. Just as another example, may not talk as much about that. Well, actually, yeah, we will talk about this in 1D. There's some examples. I mean, 1D sort of doesn't count as actually, people don't usually call those spin liquids because 1D is rather special, but there's a lot of kind of paradigmatic systems in 1D that by understanding their behavior, you can really understand a lot of what people are talking about when they're talking about 2D and 3D spin liquids and things. So it's worth understanding these 1D examples. This kind of falls under frustrated magnetism. And finally, one with maybe a bit of a question mark, but probably is correct to put it on this side, is high TC superconductors, which I won't say much about. Though we will study some models that are relevant for these on a more, you know, kind of formal level. And finally, there's even crazier things called like Bose metals, for instance, which are kind of a new idea and an active area of research. Basically, it's like a kind of a weird mix of these two sides where basically the charges stop moving, but the spins move somehow. They kind of you can kind of think of hopping, you know, from one electron to another, if you will. I don't really know how to talk about it, but basically the spins make a Fermi surface. And so it's like some kind of weird mix of this kind of phenomenon and this kind of phenomenon together. So sort of an active area of research. All right. Not really sure how to use these things. Good. So finally, one last bit of introduction, and this will kind of set the stage for what we're going to talk about this week, which are approaches for these systems, the theoretical approaches. And I was thinking about this, and I think I can kind of classify these into three headings. So and I'd be interested to get your feedback on this. So theoretical approaches for condensed matter systems. So I think roughly you can kind of put these into three categories. One is sort of like the defining approach for, well, you know, for quantum mechanics, and that's to work with wave functions. Okay, so you can always say, let's find the wave function, right? That's always sort of a safe bet, though it may be an overly complicated way of approaching the problem, right? Wave functions are very complicated. And this, you know, examples of this approach, a key example is mean field theory. So you try to find a wave function, but for like the wrong Hamiltonian, essentially. So you take your right Hamiltonian, and you say, let's replace it with a different Hamiltonian that's has a simpler type of wave function. But maybe this other Hamiltonian is sort of a good cartoon of the real one we want to study. We get the simple wave function, and then that's our approach, that kind of thing. Another example is just more extreme, is exact diagonalization. Okay, and this is essentially just solving the problem just by brute force, all right? But it's a little more elegant than that. So I went for a long time thinking when people said this that what they meant was just taking a giant matrix and just fully diagonalizing it. But actually, quite often what people mean is they use these much more interesting approaches where you can target just the ground state or something. So you can take a huge matrix and you can ask a certain algorithm called like Langshost, there's another one called Davidson, and you can actually shoot for just the ground state and you don't have to pay the price of getting all the other states or storing them on your computer. So there's kind of two versions, so Langshost or full. So you need to do full diagonalization if you're trying to study, say, finite temperature properties this way. And then finally, there's things that are kind of newer and emerging topics, such as DMRG, not so new, but still pretty useful. And then along with this is tensor networks. So this is where things get really quantum information related. And the idea here is that this is kind of like saying, let's only work with simple wave functions. This is like throwing up your hands and just saying, like, let's just use powerful computers to deal with wave functions and not really like look at their structure at all. And this is like in between, right? So this is like saying, let's kind of try to go from here to here in steps, right? So let's try to do mean field theory as a starting point, then do like one level past that, one level past that. And you're on this kind of sliding scale where one end is just doing the whole thing and one end is mean field theory. And so the idea here is that you figure out that wave functions have some kind of internal structure due to quantum information, you know, bounds and limits and things, and then you try to exploit that and make them, you know, work with them in a smarter way. Okay, so then another approach that occurred to me that people often do is they study correlation functions. Okay, so here the idea, I mean, these aren't so different, but I think it helps to make this distinction a little bit. Here the idea is that, you know, you actually have the wave function somewhere on your computer or on paper. Here you kind of don't really ever look at the wave function, essentially. You just try to go past it and compute things, right? So you kind of start from more or less the Hamiltonian or like a Lagrangian or something, and then you just try to go straight from that to doing computation. So basically this is like the approach of field theory, right? So if you think about it, when people do field theory, there is like a wave functional, but people don't often work with it, right? They usually just go straight from some kind of path integral or something, and then they just try to directly compute different correlation functions or expectation values and things, right? And so why is that the approach here? It's because integrals are easier than sums, basically, right? So when you have integrals, often you can do them on paper. You know, here it's kind of like sums, here it's more like integrals. And then an extreme example of this is conformal field theory. And this is where you can somehow define the whole thing just in terms of the correlation function. So often you don't even see people writing down an action or anything. They just say, let, you know, correlation functions have all of these different consistent behaviors. And then there's even a whole scheme where people are trying to write down constraints on correlation functions and kind of solve for these constraints and figure out properties of the field theory without ever really, you know, writing down a Hamiltonian or anything like that. So there's some very extreme examples of this approach. And then there's also other things like, say, quantum Monte Carlo, where again, you don't ever really see or obtain the wave function. You just kind of obtain properties that you would obtain from the wave function, but you're just sort of sampling out these properties by writing down, again, kind of writing down a path integral. So in a way, it's just kind of like regularizing a field theory and then just summing, doing big integrals. And then finally, leading into what we're going to talk about today and for most of this week, is this kind of more out there approach that's nonetheless very highly successful, which is density functionals. And then there's actually extensions of this, like maybe there could be potential functionals or density matrix functionals and other things like this. So this is actually interesting. This approach actually predates this approach. So there's a paper, or actually I think two papers by Thomas and Fermi, where they basically begin solving quantum mechanics without really referencing the Schrodinger equation at all. It's kind of interesting. So that's one of the oldest approaches. And I'm going to briefly touch on that. And then there's a much more refined understanding of how to use density functionals that's due to Hohenberg, Cohn, and Sham. So DFT stands for density functional theory. So that's what we'll be talking about quite a bit. So anyway, I just thought it was kind of useful to make this distinction, right? So of course, these aren't hard distinctions. Like, you can kind of pass between these. But here, you know, essentially the philosophy is no wave functions in this column, right? So somehow you're trying to skip past the wave function, which is a really messy thing, and just try to get answers without bothering with that. Okay, so now finally, before we really get into density functional theory, I think it's helpful to review Hartree-Fock, which is basically the standard mean field theory approach to many electron systems. All right, so basically the idea is that everything in DFT is always sort of referencing terminology that comes from thinking about Hartree-Fock. And also, people who use DFT, they pretty much always also do Hartree-Fock calculations. Like if you talk to a quantum chemist, whenever they show plots, they always show, you know, the Hartree-Fock result, and if they do DFT, they show that result, or maybe a more or less exact result from their quantum chemistry code. So it's just very, you know, essential to the whole thinking, basically. And so essentially, Hohenberg, Cohn, Sham DFT is a refinement of Hartree-Fock. So you can kind of think of it as sort of some improvement on Hartree-Fock. All right. But I think it'll be intellectually interesting to try to make this distinction more precise, right? Because a lot of people who don't know much about DFT, but they know kind of what it can do, they tend to think of it as almost being equal to Hartree-Fock, right? But it's really not. And this is something. This is basically the main takeaway I want you guys to get, is that it looks like Hartree-Fock, but it's philosophically like very, very, very different. Okay. So just kind of a lightning review. So I'm not going to go way into this or belabor it too much, but this is basically kind of the essential approach for a weak correlation. It's almost kind of like one way of defining it, in a sense. Like, if Hartree-Fock works, it's kind of like weak correlation. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, press that point too much, but that's sort of one way of thinking about it. And then we'll get some key terminology that we need from this, right? And it's a type of mean field theory. Maybe we'll see why. It's not so obvious in some ways of thinking about it why it's a mean field theory, but you probably already know more or less why. So one of the key pieces of terminology that we need is the idea of a Slater determinant, right? So this is the idea, first of all, of Hartree-Fock is we want to approximate the wave function of a many-body interacting system by a non-interacting one. So. Okay, and this kind of wave function, this like non-interacting type of wave function, has this kind of form, right? So we'll use the letter capital phi exclusively to refer to this type of wave function, like a non-interacting type, and it generally has a form like this. So it's just a bunch of independent creation operators acting on the vacuum. Okay, so this is the vacuum for electrons, and then we just act all these operators on it. And the idea here is you can make this more general, but here I'm just thinking of n over 2 different, I should probably write n over 2, n over 2 different orbitals, so to speak, and then each orbital is doubly occupied with an up electron and a down electron. Okay. And what do we mean by an orbital? Okay, so the idea is, how are these operators defined? Well, they're defined as the following. So they're just an integral over some function, phi j of r, you know, convolved with or weighted with a creation or annihilation operator, like this. So this is an operator that creates a position eigenstate. So it's like a delta function wave function. And then you just take that and then spread it around with different probabilities. And then these probabilities are given, or amplitudes are given by this function phi, which is called an orbital. So when people talk about orbitals, that's what they mean, right? It's just this function. And so just to give a small example of this, so these are called Slater determinants. And let's see why. So I'll just give a very quick example. So if you just have two spinless fermions, just to keep it as simple as possible.
It's a Slater determinant, and then we're talking about fermions,
right? Yeah, that's right. And we are only talking about fermions now for like this whole week. So yeah, good point. That's right. Well, so first of all, just as a cartoon, what you should think about this as doing, right, is that let's say you have a 1D system. And if you want, you can think of it as having being on some very fine lattice. I'm just kind of a lattice person, so it helps me. And then if you act on this vacuum, it has no electrons in it, with this operator, it just creates a state that looks like this. So it's some kind of delta function like that. So on a lattice, that would be something of finite height, and it would be zero everywhere, and then have some, you know, basically one on one of the sites, or one over the lattice spacing, if there's some kind of artificial lattice. And then all you're doing is you're just taking that, it's like a comb, and then you're just weighting it with different weights. So you just get these different weights like this. You know, and then that's just some funny function like that. And that's what the phi looks like. But the point is there's just one electron there. So even though it, you know, has some probability of being anywhere or everywhere, if you actually add it all up, there's just one guy. You know, that's the idea. But then you add these in one at a time and fill up the whole system with electrons. Okay, so just to say, why is this a Slater determinant? Because it doesn't look much like a determinant, right? You know, it just looks like a product. Okay, and so in some sense, this is a product state. But of course, when you're dealing with electrons, you can't really make things be totally uncorrelated the way like a bosonic or spin kind of product state is. So you always get some kind of correlations. And that's what you see when you write it in real space. So if you create the most generic one of these states for just two spinless fermions, then it looks like this. And the determinant structure comes out when you put it into the real space basis. So that just means writing out its amplitudes in real space. And you know, it's a worthwhile exercise to go through, and I encourage you to do this and check. I mean, some of you probably already know how to do this, but I just wanted to make it really explicit. And what you find is the following. Okay, so it's kind of interesting that here it really looks like a product state in second quantized form, right? But then here you see, oh, okay, it's not kind of just a product of these functions, right? It's some kind of, it has some correlations, right? It's sort of funny. Correlations in the sense, of course, that if you bring x1 and x2 close together, the thing vanishes, right? So there's some kind of restriction on the amplitudes just from the fermionic nature of what you're building it out of. Okay, and so then Hartree-Fock is basically where you... you take a Hamiltonian. We're thinking here about this kind of class of Hamiltonians. And for the rest of this week. It's also instructive to write out this kind of Hamiltonian in second quantized form, but this is the first quantized kind of regular real space version of it. Okay, so this is kinetic energy, right? Interactions and one body potential or potential energy. So any questions about this, by the way? Okay, so here I've kind of shortcutted past, I haven't gone through the whole thing of starting with, you know, the nuclei and all of that. That's in the back of our mind. So here we're just gonna work within what's called the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. So the idea is that we think of the nuclei as moving classically, right? It's not that they're not moving, right? They're moving, it's just that they're moving classically. So they're moving on some time scale that's very long compared to the time scales of this Hamiltonian. So one, you know, one kind of very important application of DFT, and this is actually an area of ongoing area of your research, is that DFT, as we'll see, gives you a way of doing very cheap calculations of very, very large and realistic systems of electrons. So then people can actually do simulations where they actually move the nuclei around, solve this whole problem, and then use that to do some kind of update. And they can actually do, you know, real-time simulations of the movement of atoms and things. Pretty interesting. And they use DFT as sort of an engine for this. And so the idea of Hartree-Fock is that you minimize the expectation value of this guy by varying these orbitals. So you treat the orbitals themselves, these different functions. You choose different functions and you plug them in, and you keep searching through the space of these functions until you manage to lower this energy to its lowest value. I should also point out that this is in what's called atomic units, like Hartree atomic units, I think it's called. And this is that the mass of the electron and H bar and the charge and some other things are equal to 1. And so in these units, the energy of the hydrogen atom, well, I don't want to, I'll write hydrogen, so I'm going to use EH for something else, is 1/2, or maybe negative 1/2, maybe positive 1/2. Okay, we'll figure out the sign later, but basically its absolute value is 1/2. So now comes more of the terminology that we're going to need and use quite a bit. And this terminology refers to different so-called energy components, right? So it's interesting to write out the energy, this, in terms of these orbitals and see what you get. You've probably seen this expression before, but just kind of good to jog our memory and see this again. And this is specialized for this case that I wrote, where we have n over 2 doubly occupied orbitals, right? So there's a more general expression you can write down that doesn't put in that assumption, but we are going to put in that assumption. Okay, so the idea is that you sum over these orbitals, integrate over all space, and get this expression for the kinetic energy. Okay, there's an integration by parts that happen there. And then you also get this kind of classical contribution to the energy that's known as the Hartree energy. Okay, where the density is defined as, I like the second quantized version of this better. And finally, you get this other interesting contribution due to the kind of Slater determinant structure. You'll see this written different ways, but I'm writing it a particular way to try to bring out a certain way of looking at it that I'll tell you in just 1 second. Okay. So, and of course, finally, the potential energy, which is not so interesting to write down, but we'll write it for completeness. Okay. Yeah, so this is called the Hartree term, or Hartree energy. You can call it EH. Of course, this is the kinetic energy, often called T. And then this guy is the so-called exchange energy. Let's think a bit more about what it is, what's it doing there, right? Or this is just the potential. V. Okay, but I'll use all these letters very consistently as we talk about density functional theory. All these letters and all these concepts come up quite a bit. Right, this idea of breaking up the energy into these different key pieces. So kinetic, Hartree, exchange, and potential. But remember, this is not the whole story, right? Because this is just where we've assumed that the wave function is a Slater determinant, which is basically, it's never really true, right, unless you turn off interactions. But here we're always thinking of interactions as being on and sort of a fixed type, right? I didn't say what VEE was, but you know, generally you can think of it as Coulomb interactions, all right? So this is, you know, most of the energy, if you will, but there's an extra piece that's missing that we'll talk about called correlation. Okay, and that's what's missing. At least this is like the chemistry definition of correlation. Let's see a bit more about what is this exchange term and what is it doing there. Any questions so far about Hamiltonian or what I'm doing. This is probably a review for most of you, I'm sure. So let's define this function g sigma of r, r prime, where we take our, you can define it more generally, but here I'm defining it for our Slater determinant. Okay, and so if you put an arbitrary wave function here, this thing is called the single particle green function. And for the special case of the Slater determinant, it has this form, or you can compute it this way, which is that you take all your orbitals. You know, again, here, assuming we have n over 2 orbitals that are doubly occupied, and you sum over all the orbitals, but you put different arguments into the phi star and the phi. Okay, so this is for a Slater determinant. And so what is this thing, right? So this thing is basically a something that people compute quite a lot because it actually matters a good bit in experiments. So many, many experimental probes coupled to this or some kind of different sums over this guy, right? So this is a type of density matrix, actually. So you know, a density matrix in general is when you take a wave function and then you trace over most of the degrees of freedom, but you like leave a few of the degrees of freedom fixed or open as sort of external probes. Right, so you can do these in real space. This is, it looks like it's in real space, but it's really in like kind of particle label space, right? So r and r prime are positions of two particular particles that we've kind of pinned down. But of course, by anti-symmetry, they could be any of the particles, right? But you know, just think of this as two of the particular particles that we've kind of nailed down, and then we let all the other particles run around and do whatever they do, and we probe the system that way, okay? So this is something that comes up quite a lot in many, many different contexts. But here, it's interesting to define this because then you can see that that this part of the energy, so this interaction part, so let's call this whole thing VEE equals everything inside that box. That so basically everything that has a VEE in it. That in terms of this guy, VEE equals the following. So. This is just to give a physical interpretation of what this funny exchange energy is. And this will be basically the last thing I say about Hartree-Fock, but I just wanted to kind of get our heads in the right place before we get rid of the wave function, essentially. Okay, so that's the idea, right? So if you can basically take the, so originally we had VEE, and you can either write it as, you know, involving these position operators. Another way would be you can write it as a function times the density operator twice, so n of r prime. But when you actually wrap the Slater determinant around it, you find that the energy, all the interaction energy can be written this way. So here's again this Hartree part. So the Hartree part is like the classical part. So this is where, if things were as uncorrelated as possible, so really if the electrons were absolutely ignoring each other, even not even anti-commuting, right, this would be the interaction energy they would have, right? So then this is kind of everything else. And so we see that this basically has to do with correlations. But they're only statistical in nature, right? Which means, you know, the kind of correlations we can never get rid of, right, just because we have fermions, right? So there's like the minimum amount kind of correlations. Interestingly, you can see by writing it in this form, maybe it was apparent here as well, but it's especially apparent here, that this is lowering the energy, right? So, you know, interactions, you think of it as something that raises the energy, right? They're repelling, so they always pay energy. But here, they somehow manage to, even though they overall pay, they manage to have some savings by avoiding each other, right? So this is a really key concept to think about. Yeah, that's right. This would also be the Fock. So that's, yeah, so Hartree-Fock, it's like originally Hartree focused on this term, and then Fock later pointed out, okay, this term is also generically always there in this kind of mean field picture.
You used the word correlations for two different things. Is that right?
Yeah, I kind of did. You mean like this kind of strong correlations well, versus this?
So
or?
Chemistry one and then this one here. They're different, right?
Oh, yeah. That was actually the very next thing I was going to say. So yeah, this correlation energy definition. Right, so there's sort of a distinction between what chemistry people call it and what DFT people call it. And this is going to be kind of my last thing about Hartree-Fock. So, yeah, so exactly, right. So what I wrote over there, yeah, I said that the real interacting, the real exact energy, if you could somehow find it, would have to have this extra piece. That's just a way of saying that Hartree-Fock is not exact. So yeah, exactly. So we wanted to find the correlation energy. Right, and this is the chemistry definition. And I'm making this distinction because we'll see it come up in the DFT context, and it's defined differently there, and we can talk about what the difference is. But basically, the chemistry definition is just the exact energy. Like, if we could just take this Hamiltonian and find its exact ground state, right, and find its energy, minus the Hartree-Fock energy. Okay, so that'll become important later because you'll see a little subscript C appearing somewhere in some energy terms that we're going to discuss. And it's a different one from this one, but it's not that different. It's just sort of a key minor difference. And finally, just now to kind of think about moving toward DFT. So the idea is that that basically Hartree-Fock works okay. Like, it works pretty well. And so it remains like a standard approach. People do, you know, real chemical calculations, right? So if you see people study like real water molecules and fully in 3D with all the, you know, realistic, what's called a basis set, which means they consider all the atomic orbitals. You know, Hartree-Fock works okay, but basically Cohn and his collaborators, they showed that you can do, sorry, I have a hard time talking and writing. So you can do much better if basically you choose your Slater determinant to have the same density as the exact one, okay? So that was the key insight of Cohn and his collaborators, so Hohenberg and Cham. And so it's a kind of a surprising fact, right? So the idea is that you would think if someone says, okay, your tool is a Slater determinant, that's what you're allowed to work with, right? What are you going to do with the Slater determinant to try to understand this problem? You would think, okay, let me try to get it as close to the ground state as I can by making it have as low as energy as possible. But what we're going to see is that actually a better thing to do with having a Slater determinant as your main tool is to try to get it to have the same density as the exact one, and that's sort of a surprising fact. But then when you do this, you don't get the energy by wrapping this Slater determinant around the original Hamiltonian. You use the Slater determinant as some kind of tent poles to try to support this density. So you try to, you know, obtain this density using Slater determinants as your tool, and then you take this density and you put it into some kind of functional that will develop, right? And this functional basically looks at the density and says, okay, here's your energy. And surprisingly, you can do much better. You get much more accurate energies this way. Yeah. The density that the exact system has. So,
as in, like, when you say density, I mean, you've written up a Slater determinant.
Yeah.
You haven't told me a thing about what
the. Yeah, okay, so this is a very good and basic question, so I'm glad you asked. Yeah, okay, so I just thought it was implicit, but maybe it's not. So the idea is that if you have this Hamiltonian, okay, you solve for its ground state. Okay, this is just a thought experiment. So you exactly solve for its ground state, and you get it. Okay, so now call this psi zero, right? And then take psi zero and take the expectation value of the density operator, which I think I already wrote out in more detail over here, right? So the density operator is just the creation operator and the annihilation operator put together like that, right? And that's a function which we call by the same letter, call it n of r, but without the hat. So this is an operator, this is a function. And that's the exact density. And then the idea is that you want to choose a Slater determinant so that when you compute the following, maybe you can call this NS for single particle. Often people in density functional theory put little S's underneath things to say that they come from Slater determinants. And you want to get this close to, ideally, the same as the exact density, okay? Which is something that you don't know. You never know it, but you can imagine that it exists and has some particular form. right? Yeah, good question. Thanks for bringing that up. And in practice, how much better can you do? Just as a quick kind of cartoon sketch, just to give you an idea. It may not seem that impressive, but it's a big deal when you're actually doing real serious calculations of huge 3D problems and real systems, and you've already put in all the detail of the real Hamiltonian down to like this kind of so-called ab initio or like, you know, atomic level. So this is just an example of a real H2 molecule. And this is the internuclear spacing. So if you, again, it's kind of Born-Oppenheimer approach. So if you take the nuclei and you actually pin them down at different distances, maybe at their equilibrium distance of where they would actually be from experiment, and you also stretch them or kind of push them together, and then you include all these atomic orbitals and you treat everything totally realistically in 3D, and you solve it, then there's these very fancy quantum chemical methods where they can get the exact result, and it looks roughly like this. Okay, so this minimum here basically tells you that if you don't do anything, if you don't put any external force on the molecule, that's the distance at which they'll sit, right? And then if you do Hartree-Fock, it's not so great. You know, you get something like this. So that's kind of what Hartree-Fock looks like. So when you do this kind of DFT, which we'll talk a lot more about, and you use some kind of standard approximations, which are actually rather simple to write down, it works really well. It works surprisingly well. And it makes kind of only a systematic error. So this is LDA, Cohn-Sham DFT. I'll define what all these mean. So that may not look like, you know, huge improvement, but basically it's a major improvement, right? Because this is some kind of huge reduction in errors. And the errors are systematic. So you make tiny errors here, and then they mostly just get bigger as you go over here, right, as you stretch. And we'll kind of discuss why stretching a molecule might make these errors bigger. Basically, it gets more strongly correlated over here.
Yeah. There are other types of DFT improvements.
That's right. So there's other types. So there's other variants of DFT. There's things called like orbital-free DFT, where you basically get rid of the Cohn-Sham part. Because we'll talk about the Cohn-Sham part is when you bring Slater determinants into the picture. There's also other approximations. So there's LDA is a major approximation. There's also things called GGAs and hybrids and all this other stuff, which I wasn't planning to talk about in great depth, but I can mention what those are. Yeah.
I'm still a little bit confused about what physically the Hartree-Fock thing is leading out.
Yeah, right. Well, basically on the most, that's a good question. So what is the Hartree-Fock leaving out, he's asking? So essentially the wave function is not a Slater determinant ever, unless you really turn the interactions off, right? And so you can't turn the interactions off. What you can do is try to maybe build them into a non-interacting picture of the real system, but they're always there. And the question, you know, one question is, do they always have an effect, but is the effect merely quantitative? Which, you know, let's not discount quantitative, right? That's really important for studying real systems and doing applications. Or is the effect quantitative, and do we need to really reapproach the whole problem from a different side, right? That's one key question. Is this answering your question? Okay, so basically the wave function just is not a Slater determinant. So trying to use a Slater determinant as an approximation of the wave function, it kind of works. But, you know, not that
so
well.
So when chemists discover correlation the error when you do that?
Yeah, exactly. So the chemistry definition of correlation is just this, you know, that difference at different, you know, for different values of R in this case, or for whatever parameter you're tuning to, you know, to study different systems. And the DFT definition is not so different, but it's important just to say that it is different. Okay, so we don't have a lot more time for today. But maybe I'll at least get started on DFT proper. Right, so just, you know, one other comment is that, so this was the exact result. So there's all these methods to actually find the full wave function, right? So for these kind of small chemical systems, which we're not going to go way into these kind of molecular systems and all that, but basically people can more or less just find the exact wave function, right? They do some smarter things to sort of set up the problem. They might freeze out some of the core orbitals, or like some of the electrons that are deep in the core of the atoms. And they may also exclude, you know, they're not going to actually somehow mathematically work with all the possible excited states of each atom that you could have. But other than that, they basically can find the exact wave function in many cases, right? So this kind of thing. And it's definitely not a Slater determinant, right? And we'll actually later in the week, we'll look at the wave function again. So kind of right now, we're basically putting the wave function aside. The only wave functions we're going to deal with are sort of artificial wave functions that are, they're these Slater determinants, but they're not found by minimizing the energy. They're found, they're just sort of tent poles to make densities to try to get them close to whatever this putative exact density that we're never going to really see, right? It's kind of a very funny approach to the problem, right? But then you know, toward the end of the week, we'll actually go back and say, okay, we're going to see strong correlation come up, and then we're going to say, what is the wave function really? You know, when it's weakly correlated, it really is actually a lot like a Slater determinant. But then when it's strongly correlated, it's very different, right? And so we'll kind of see what is it, right? Yeah, that's right. So that's actually the chemistry viewpoint of what strong correlation is they will talk about, they'll talk about a Slater determinant as a reference. They'll say the word reference a lot because they use methods like coupled cluster, which we're not going to go into, but where basically they take a Slater determinant and then they create excitations within it. So they kind of let the, you know, they have orbitals that are occupied and orbitals that are unoccupied, and then they let the electrons sort of move up into these unoccupied guys. And so they think of a Slater determinant as like their vacuum out of which everything is being made. And so then they like to think about there's just being kind of one vacuum or something. It sort of went kind of one. I'm not going to explain this perfectly because I don't do quantum chemistry. But the idea is that what you'll hear a quantum chemist say when things become really strongly correlated is they'll say it's a multi-reference system. And what they mean is that it's like the vacuum is a sum of Slater determinants, right? But that's a bit of a kind of roundabout way of describing strong correlation, because some strongly correlated systems, as we'll see, you know, you could say it's like a infinite sum of Slater determinants or something, but what it really is just a bunch of electrons not moving anywhere. They're just sort of sitting in place, right? So I think that's a much more natural way of describing what they're doing than saying it's a sum of Slater determinants, right? Why don't you just say they're just not moving, you know? So at some point, the whole Slater determinant picture just totally breaks down and it becomes a really kind of ludicrous way of describing the wave function, actually. But on the weakly correlated side, it's actually a very smart way of describing the wave function, and that's kind of why DFT works so well, in part. So maybe I'll just kind of motivate DFT really fast, and then we'll kind of end for today. And tomorrow we'll actually go into some first examples of kind of early attempts at DFT, and then we'll go into like the really kind of correct approach to DFT, this kind of Hohenberg-Cohn-Sham approach. So just some quick motivation. Okay, so DFT is a really powerful and it's really practical method. And people can do large and realistic systems with it. So they really can actually start all the way down from like chemistry of atoms, right? You can actually start from all this stuff you guys have learned about, you know, shell structure of atoms and all this, and you can actually study all these different orbitals. Then you can actually construct like a reduced Hilbert space that you can work in, where you basically work with what are called the active orbitals. So these are the ones that actually have some chance of being sometimes occupied, sometimes not, this kind of thing. Whereas you have other orbitals that are maybe always fully occupied, you know, with 100% chance, you know, probability, and other ones that are always empty with 100% probability, more or less. So those you can kind of exclude from the picture or just deal with in some kind of classical or average way. But basically, other than that, you're working with like, you're like working in the continuum with the real orbitals describing the real atoms of the system. And because of this, people call these methods ab initio. So you're not approximating the Hamiltonian at all. So this is really powerful, right? Because then you can get energies that actually match experiment and actually predict properties of real material. So this is like a really big deal. And often another phrase you hear thrown around is the electronic structure problem. So I'm just kind of throwing out some terminology for you. So electronic structure basically refers to this kind of Hamiltonian, right? So the full problem involves the motion of the nuclei as well and all the interactions between the nuclei and this kind of thing. But if you just freeze the nuclei, then you're just studying the electrons and kind of what structure they have. And so that's what people mean when they say electronic structure. And so DFT is basically, you can think of it as a reorganization of quantum mechanics, you use the density as the basic variable. All right, so kind of the mantra of DFT is no psi, right? So no wave function. You just try to like never see the wave function, never talk about the wave function. You maybe work with wave functions, but they're just tent poles for the density. That's kind of the idea. It's one way of thinking about it. They're also where you get the, most of the kinetic energy from, as we'll see as well. And so this is a massive simplification. It's not an oversimplification. It's just very clever simplification. So the idea is that you take this wave function, which in kind of first quantized notation is a big function of 3n coordinates. Right? So there's 3n arguments to this thing. Right? It's 3n dimensional. And you replace it with just this one function that's just three-dimensional. Right? So think about how much of a simplification that is, because here we're talking about, you know, 10 to the 23 electrons. So, you know, 3 times 10 to the 23 going to 3, right? That's pretty nice simplification of the problem. And kind of last bit for today, I'll just tell you kind of why we expect this works. Yeah, that's a really good question, right? So the quantum information angle on this, right? So at this point, the quantum information angle is a bit kind of just, you know, kind of words, like people haven't really made this too precise. I mean, there has been some work on the complexity theory questions about DFT, right? Like, does somehow moving to this formalism, you know, get you around some of like the hardness of quantum mechanics? And of course it, you know, of course it doesn't, right? You still find everything is like NP hard at least. You're asking about the entanglement. Right, so as we'll see, this is a reorganization, but it's not cheating in any way. So all you're doing is you're saying density is a basic variable, but as we'll see, determining the density determines the full wave function. So in principle, you can actually write like an entanglement functional. So you could actually say...
the assumption that you got a Slater.
No, so you actually don't have to have a Slater determinant. So the idea is, we'll see it. So the idea is basically, you have to make some assumptions, like you assume that the ground state is unique, which is a pretty strong assumption, but it's a okay one for many cases, like in many real systems. And so then once you've assumed that the density drives everything. So you use the Slater determinant as some intermediate step, right? So you use it as some kind of construction that then you kind of throw away, right? And then the real wave function is definitely not a Slater determinant, right? But it's just, you never see it. It's never there. It's just only there kind of in the formalism somewhere, but you never actually write it down. And then we'll see that, though, that the real wave function really is determined totally by the density, which is shocking and kind of scandalous. And so if you're shocked by this, you should be. It's really weird, but it turns out we'll actually prove it rigorously in one of, like maybe on Wednesday. And so then once you've determined the wave function from the density in principle, then everything, of course, you know, kind of comes out of that. So even in principle, some of the excited state information should come out of this, though the whole formalism we'll talk about is ground state based. But yeah, entanglement even should be a functional of the density. And the thing is, we know some functionals of the density pretty well, like the energy. And the thing is, there may be a lot of, this is what I mean about it may actually be an interesting research direction for you guys, is there may be other functionals that are quite simple to write down that no one has just tried or succeeded. So there may be that there's a very simple like entanglement functional that no one has tried to write down, but maybe one of you could write it down. So just kind of last bit of motivation, right? So so why is DFT a success? Last thing for today, so just wanted to put these out there. So it's based on exact principles. So as we'll see tomorrow, DFT is one of the oldest approaches to quantum many-body physics, but the early attempts were sort of very heuristic, and we'll go through some of those. They're interesting, but they're very coarse and kind of, you know, approximate. But the Cohn-Sham version of DFT, or actually the kind of Hohenberg-Cohn version of DFT, is totally based on exact principles. So this is one reason why it's powerful, is that people use a lot of approximations, but the idea is that tomorrow someone could come out with a much better approximation, and so on and so on, and there's sort of no end to this, and we could actually approach the exact result if we just made better and better approximations. So that's important, right? Because like mean field theory, it's not exactly that way, right? I mean, once you've kind of made a mean field approximation, you're just kind of stuck with that, essentially. You know, and you can't really systematically improve on it so easily. I mean, you kind of can if you move to tensor networks, but within mean field, it's not so easy to just improve on it. Another reason is that you basically get, primarily all you get out of it at the moment is the ground state energy and density, but these are very useful quantities. Now again, as I was saying, people are finding out ways to get other quantities other than the energy and the density, but already this has been a big revolution in physics, just getting accurate energies for realistic systems, right? So if you think about it, you can get a lot of things from the energy, right? So you can get, well, the energy itself, but then you can get things like, for chemistry, you can get things like the equilibrium bond distance of molecules. Also, you can study the second derivative of this minimum, and you can get characteristic frequencies. So you can think of these, if these molecules sort of vibrate in this minimum, some classical way, you can see their characteristic vibration, this kind of thing. So there's a lot of stuff you can actually get just out of energy information. You can study phonons, all kind of things. And there's this Cohn-Sham formulation we'll talk about. We'll talk about that, but basically you can move the nuclei around, and then you can study how much the energy changes. Essentially, that's basically the idea. So you can do a bunch of ground state, you do multiple ground state calculations, and you can get sort of low energy excitation information out of the system. There's a whole formalism for doing this. I'm not a big expert on how. You actually can. So there's a whole extension of DFT called time-dependent DFT. And it's not that people necessarily actually make, you know, movies of the system moving in time, but they get, yeah, like frequency-dependent information about the system. So yeah, it's a good question. So there's this Cohn-Sham formalism is another reason for the success. And this is that thing I was saying about the Slater determinant. So you have a auxiliary non-interacting problem. Okay, a Slater determinant comes out of this. And so this is interesting, and this is one of the main reasons I wanted to teach you guys about this, is because those of you who are gonna work seriously in the field of condensed matter, you're gonna go to conferences and you're gonna see lots of band structures all the time if you go to more applied talks, or you're gonna hear people talking about this, right? Because there's a lot of people even who work on more conceptual aspects of condensed matter that work on weakly correlated systems, right? So people, like for instance, Anton Burkov over at Waterloo, he's been one of the main people working on this topic of vial semi-metals, and these, they're being proposed, there's actually experiments being done and proposed where people are using DFT to basically do the experiment on a computer and figure out if the band structure of the system has this kind of vial semi-metal structure. Then they're actually going in the lab and looking for this very exotic, very interesting and cool physics, right? So this is the starting point for all of that kind of search. Right. So reason I was saying that in this case is that you'll see these band structures, and there's a lot of misconceptions even among the people who actually do these DFT calculations about what these band structures mean, right? So people will say, here's the band structure of a system, but if you're a very kind of formally minded person, you'll realize that interacting systems basically don't have band structures, right? Because a band structure is a totally non-interacting electron concept. So what are these band structures? What do they mean? And kind of what can we say about them that's actually accurate? Finally, there's the local density approximation, which we'll talk about in depth, and it's called LDA. And this is a kind of a nice approximation because it's very conceptually very clean and simple to define, and it's unique, right? So once you define it, it's just sort of only one LDA. And then after you go beyond LDA into other kinds of functional approximations, there's a whole zoo, and it's almost kind of a bit of a scandal how many there are. And it sort of has given a bit of a black eye to the field, maybe, that there's so many. But then there's sort of an extreme limit of this, right? So there's sort of LDA, and then there's these things called like GGAs and hybrids. Hybrids are pretty weird. They're like you actually mix Hartree-Fock and DFT together. It's a bit of black magic, but it's been put on sort of more respectable grounds. And then on the totally other extreme end, there's even machine learning now that's being done. I can talk about this more if you guys are interested in it, where people are actually saying they're just throwing up their hands on trying to be principled about where these how these functionals are defined. So instead of doing careful uniform gas derivations of these functionals, they're literally just teaching big computers. They're just throwing a bunch of densities into big computers and feeding in energies along with those densities as a training set. And then they're just throwing in other densities now that the computer hasn't seen, and it's reporting back to them the energy. So this is really scary, right? Because like, it's almost like robots replacing condensed matter physicists, right? So it's like, instead of us solving the problem, we just solve it a few times, and then the computer just fills in everything else, right? And it doesn't know anything about quantum mechanics. There's no wave function. It's pretty scary, right? And finally, kind of along with the machine learning thing, it's computationally cheap. But you know, even though it's computationally very cheap, somehow it's not cheap enough for a lot of the people who do it. because they're trying even to get rid of the non-interacting part of the calculation, the cone sham part. Even that has gotten too expensive for a lot of people. So like kind of last story of the day is that I've been told that there's actually a researcher who got a grant to buy a hydroelectric dam because he needed so much energy to power his computers to do this. And so he's running calculations all day and all night of this type because they're so useful to have. So they can't get enough of them. So he's running them all the time. So he actually has an entire hydroelectric station just for his computers. And he runs these calculations all year. And then at the end of the year, he might get 3 or 4 materials that he finds that are sort of candidate materials, maybe to be interesting superconductors or something like this. And he's just running these things all day and all night. So this is kind of US tax dollars at work, for example. So, all right, that's it for today. Any other questions about any of that? There's been some good ones, so.
Where do you put low pieces of like just standard superconductors in the microcontroller?
Oh yeah, that was a key thing I forgot to write. Yeah, that's probably one of the best examples of interesting weakly correlated systems. So yeah, I would put BCS superconductor over here. You know, maybe you can debate a little bit about how weakly correlated it is, but yeah, exactly. My point is just that, yeah, you can use mean field theory. So then you can sort of solve a type of non-interacting Hamiltonian and get a full understanding of what is going on. So I would put it over here mostly. Yeah. So my point, yeah, one point about that is that weakly correlated by no means means boring, right? It just, in fact, it's really remarkable that you can use a non-interacting picture to understand that much phenomena, right? Okay, thanks, guys.